taking refuge in the Dharma, as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking, boy, I kind of picked the no-brainer easy topic for tonight because it's just so wonderful and healing and beautiful and restful and nourishing to take refuge in the Dharma. We're supported tonight in doing that by a wonderful anonymous donor who's paying tribute to somebody who allowed us to take refuge in the Dharma, really supported the Sangha for years on a regular basis. Frank paid for our rent, you know, like it's like once a month for years. And so I know this was a place where he could take refuge in the Dharma. So just talking about the Dharma, what is the Dharma? The Dharma can mean, translated as the truth of the way things are, or the teachings that point us towards the truth of the way things are. And we take refuge in them. You know, it's one of the triple gems, the Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha, we take refuge in. And the Buddha, we can think of it as him as a historical figure, but also just really our own potential for awakening, because Buddha means awake. And the Dharma, as I said, the truth of the way things are, or the teachings, and the Sangha, the community of practitioners. You know, when we come together and practice together, it's different. It's supportive. It's inspiring. There's something almost kind of indescribable about the support we get. Tonight I'm going to focus on taking refuge in the Dharma. And just in a personal way, I find it helpful, I've found it helpful in many ways to boil down what might be conceptual things in the Dharma to what's most resonates and supports my practice in many ways. And in taking refuge in the Dharma, which I feel like I was lucky enough to, I incorporated into my practice pretty early on, since about 2006. I started taking refuge consciously every time I sat in the morning. So taking refuge in the Dharma, and eventually I got to the point where when I was saying that, well, I take refuge in the Dharma, the truth of the way things are, that it was just, for me it was just, I take refuge in mindfulness and loving kindness. I'm just going to keep turning back to that. Because I know that, because I've known that from experience, that that is the way, the actual way towards greater peace and freedom, and towards greater compassion, is just to keep turning back to those two things. Those are really the only two ways. There's no other, I had not found another effective way, period, to get through it all. And so, it can be helpful to really kind of see what resonates for you in thinking about taking refuge in the truth of the way things are, taking refuge in what has been proven to you experientially through this practice to be what's onward leading for you. It's really helpful to have that way of encapsulating for ourselves what brings the heart alive. Another way of kind of boiling it down and talking about taking refuge in the Dharma is we're taking refuge in non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion. We don't really have to take, it's interesting that we don't really have to take refuge in much more than that, because we don't have to add to it. If greed, hatred, and delusion are not there, what's there? That's a natural open heart towards ourselves and others. Non-greed and non-hatred are pretty self-explanatory, but non-delusion is really not taking things that are impermanent to be permanent. And I find I just have to remind myself of that all the time, taking refuge in non-delusion, taking refuge in not believing that this particular thing that I think is ruining my life is actually some kind of permanent thing rather than some passing phenomena, something that's slipping away. So it's through, you know, living in harmony with impermanence that we find this freedom that the Dharma offers. So it's interesting how much, you know, I am kind of a Sutta Dharma nerd. I read the suttas. I have read some of them. And I find them really amazing and interesting, fascinating. But one of the fascinating things that I've seen is that the Dharma is often characterized as the safe path. To not follow the Dharma, to not take refuge in the Dharma, really all three of the gems, but is to follow the dangerous path. It's dangerous. This is the true safety. And it's interesting what that is. The danger, it's kind of flipping danger and safety on its head in a way, because in our deluded states, we tend to think, oh, it's really safe to run away from our experience that's happening moment to moment. It's really safe to take refuge. It's really safe to take refuge in believing, like, you know, I'll be really happy if I get that sweater I saw online, or you know, those kind of things that our minds constantly trick us into. That's our little delusions. But really, those things, the more we practice, we see how fragile. It's all quite fragile. And so that's what where the danger is. Like, all of that is fragile. It's not something that we can rely on. Certainly we can't rely on the hatred part of it, you know? Boy, if I continue to be sufficiently angry at my boss, it's really going to make me happy. The safe path is the path instead of turning back again and again to mindfulness and to loving kindness. So not relying on things that are unreliable, instead relying on our capacity to be with what's happening in the present moment, even if it's something we would tend to push away. So taking refuge in the Dhamma is kind of, seems to me, involves a little bit of a reflection on the kind of a seed of what we call wise view. Wise view is that I was referring to earlier of, like, not taking things that are impermanent to be permanent. But also wise view is kind of understanding the Four Noble Truths. In that little adjustment of view, then we start to kind of see, oh, how can I relate to my experience differently? How can I relate to it through mindfulness and loving kindness instead of through craving, which is in the Four Noble Truths, it's the second noble truth, is that craving is the cause or the origin of our suffering. And it's further broken down into, oh, well, craving, there's three kinds: craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming, which people don't talk about so much, but is a very, very common experience. And so, you know, in taking refuge in the Dharma, we can take refuge in noticing, is there craving? How am I wanting something to be different right now? I noticed this cartoon. It was two runners next to each other standing there. One of them had a water bottle, and one of them said to the other, I'm thinking about letting myself grow old. You know? Instead of constantly trying to create the conditions that are not in line, in harmony with impermanence, we can turn towards our experience as it truthfully is and accept it. One of my friends told me a little while ago that she had this experience of being severely, she was like really seriously criticized. It was an experience of just getting a lot of criticism. And she went and she just did this equanimity practice, which was saying to herself, it's similar to a metta practice if you've done it, where you say phrases to yourself. Some of you may have done equanimity practice, but she just did the phrase over and over again, may I accept things just as they are. May I accept things just as they are. And it worked. She's like, it worked. You know, she didn't feel that she was weighed down by the criticism. She felt that she could go and address the situation just by accepting the fact that it was actually happening. And then being able to see with clarity. And this just seems to me like a really great example of just taking refuge in the Dharma instead of getting lost in the cravings, the craving for the criticism not to be happening, the craving for perhaps wanting the praise instead. Just may I accept what's actually happening right now. So that's really just a great example of taking refuge in the Dharma instead of taking refuge in what the mind kind of deludes us into thinking is the trick to happiness. Well, if I'm just angry enough at this situation, then that's the way to happiness. And it's just so fascinating that it's not. And that's the paradox of the Dharma in a way. It's a bit paradoxical. We make our difficulties the path, right? So it's in turning towards our experiences of suffering that we start to see how the mechanism of being released from that kind of suffering. I mean, it only seems paradoxical because we misapprehend that turning away from suffering is the way to be free, is the way that will have relief. When it's so the opposite. And it's kind of in this still attention being paid, deep attention being paid to the present moment, that actually we are able to touch into a sort of deeper stillness that can give us a tremendous amount of peace, that we can see, wow, I can actually rely on that on a pretty regular basis. Even in those moments of like, oh, that deep, deep criticism, my heart is hurting. Oh, but I can actually meet my experience, can actually turn towards it and see that it's shifting and changing. And I can be still and just watch it and notice it with a lot of love and compassion. This is not a dry kind of indifferent, oh, I'm just going to watch it, you know. As I was driving here today, I was kind of cresting the hill over Burnell Hill, and I saw this hawk above the hill. Just, you know how hawks are like on the air, and they just got, I guess they've got the temperature and all the air is just pushing them upwards so that they're just floating still, you know, floating still within all the air streams. They've caught that perfect kind of wave. They look so sort of, they look so majestic, but also they're really riding the waves of life without being flustered by anything and knowing and being very aware of everything that's going on. And of course, it just kind of reminded me, sometimes, you know, mindfulness or the Dharma is compared to surfing in a way, because the life will throw everything at you. The four worldly winds, they talk about them, praise and blame and gain and loss, and I can't remember those. I'm just like Howie. Or maybe I'm just doomed to be like Howie in this. I won't be able to complete my lists. Oh, why? Being recorded. praise and blame and gain and loss, and someone else can complete them. Joy and sorrow. Pleasure and pain, yeah. So those are the four worldly winds. Noemi, thank you. Eight. The four sets, eight worldly winds. So we have all of... Those are coming for all of us. They're in the cards. They've happened already to all of us, and they're gonna keep on coming. And we need to learn how to meet our experience. And so it's like, in a way, being a hawk and finding the way to be in harmony with all of the conditions that are coming at us, and find with a lot of love that an imperturbable place of caring for ourselves and caring for others in the midst of all of that. Because as human beings, that's what we're experiencing. So we find that kind of stillness in the midst of all of it. One of the ways, the best ways to do that, I feel like, to take refuge in the Dharma and to find that peaceful place is through mindfulness of the body, which I just think, and according to the Buddha, cannot be overemphasized. What did he say? There is one thing that when cultivated and regularly practiced leads to deep spiritual intention, to peace, to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to vision and knowledge, to a happy life here and now, and to the culmination of wisdom and awakening. And what is that one thing? It is mindfulness centered on the body. And Gil Fronsdal writes that during his practice, one of the great Thai masters, Ajahn Buddhadasa, told him, do not do anything that takes you out of your body. Do nothing that takes you out of your body. What would it be like if we practiced in that way? You know, just not going to do anything that's going to take me out of my body. So this mindfulness of the body can be this refuge. Because it's in a way, you know, it's the body's always there. It's a way of resting the experience in the present moment. To maintain mindfulness of the body, it can be just extremely peaceful to at least know at all times, sort of, or as much as possible, what's the posture even? So, it's interesting though that in taking refuge in the Dhamma, there's that stillness that we can see as a true refuge. But we also need an urgency to practice. That's another sort of paradox in the Dhamma. We're practicing with cultivating peace and ease and tranquility and that attention to the present moment in which we can rest the loving awareness. And yet there's an aim. There's an aim, and in taking refuge in the Dhamma, we can feel often that urgency of wanting more of the Dhamma, you know, because we are getting that sense as we practice that it is giving us greater peace and freedom. And so, and that's in the way that the taking refuge in the Dharma in terms of taking refuge in the teachings is really an incredibly supportive and also essential part of taking refuge in the Dhamma, to keep turning back to the teachings. Because it's so interesting, isn't it, how we have to hear it over and over again? Because it's that non-delusion. And our minds are conditioned to simply fall back into, you know, the unwise view, the kind of deluded states of what the kind of false things that will make us happy. Howie always often tells this little I think it's a Rumi poem. He talks about the man who is being dragged behind a farting camel. He's searching for the counterfeit coins, and he's being dragged behind a farting camel. And those counterfeit coins, those are the deluded ideas of what's going to make us happy, you know? Like if I get the right car, or, you know, I really want this house, or whatever it might be. Those counterfeit coins that will leave you like a broken man dragging behind a farting camel. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it always, almost always gets a laugh for me. I've heard it many, many times in this room. So we need to keep hearing the Dharma so that we're not bamboozled by the counterfeit coins over and over again. And it just helps, it kind of helps to break through the delusion. And that's how it's taught. And that's what it's referred to in the classical teachings, that hearing the Dhamma is one of the best antidotes for doubt. It's also just necessary to keep coming back to it repetitiously. One of my favorite suttas, like I said, I'm a sutta dharma nerd, but this is just such a sweet one. And it's such a practical kind of description of the path of practice. It strikes me as one of, in the actual suttas, one of the most realistic. It talks about, first of all, how you seek out a teacher and you test them out, you check them out. You check them out for greed, hatred, and delusion. This is what the suttas say y'all are supposed to be doing. All of you in this room, practitioners, check out the teachers for greed, hatred, and delusion. Keep doing it too. It's really important. Really important. And if you find someone who passes the greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion tests, then you lend an ear to that person. This is the translation. Love it. Growing close to a teacher, she lends ear. Lending ear, she hears the Dhamma. Hearing the Dhamma, she remembers the Dhamma. Remembering the Dhamma, she understands the meaning of the Dhamma. Understanding the meaning, she agrees. She agrees with the Dhamma. In agreement, zeal for practice arises. With the arising of zeal, she applies will or effort. She contemplates it, and she makes effort. She makes effort and realizes the ultimate meaning of the truth with her body and sees it by penetrating with discernment. This is how someone awakens to the truth. But, the Buddha says, this is how someone awakens to the truth. They start off on that path. They pick out the teacher, test them out, lend ear, hear the Dhamma, understand it, zeal arises, then they start practicing, and then they become awakened to the truth. But the final realization of the truth does not happen this way. The final arrival at the truth requires the repetition, development, and cultivation of that whole path over and over again. So it's the repetitious hearing of the Dhamma, turning towards the Dhamma, having zeal arise and continuing to practice, that leads us further and further towards the awakening of the truth and the final realization of the truth. So this is such a portrait, I feel like, it's a portrait of what I've done in this room for years. You know? And it's sweet. It's sweet, and it's very sweet to connect with other people who are doing it. This is the way that we take refuge in the Dhamma and the Sangha together. Taking refuge in the teachings is something that's been going on for a long time. Doesn't that sound familiar, that process? And it's beautiful to feel connected with that. So we need to take refuge in the teachings. We can do it by coming to a group like this. We can do it by getting on Dharma Seed. We can do it by going retreats. But turning back to that, and this is a relational part of the practice. Important to point out, because I think sometimes the practice gets portrayed or thought of as, oh, these individual, it's not relational, just sitting there with your on your cushion by yourself with your mind freaking out. But no, we have to connect. We have to hear the Dhamma. It's from our Dharma friends too, our regular friends, not just teachers. One of my favorite little pithy sayings from the suttas is that there are two conditions for the arising of wise view: appropriate attention and the voice of another. So we need that voice of another. Taking refuge in the Dhamma requires us to take refuge in each other and in perhaps someone who may have practiced more to some degree, someone who's offering, someone that we've tested out for greed, hatred, and delusion. And I say that and I repeat that because it's important. Not all the teachers, some teachers have fallen into, not loving awareness hasn't penetrated every aspect of their being, and and then difficulty arises. But as when I started off, I mentioned that for me, often taking refuge in the Dhamma is reminding myself just to turn back again and again. The thing to do is to turn back to mindfulness and loving kindness. So taking refuge in loving kindness, it's just so powerful. I read this quote recently by James Baldwin, the great American writer James Baldwin. I just love this quote. "Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within." Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within. So there's this part of us that knows we can't live with some of the obscurations of mind and heart that cause us to kind of create false selves, perhaps false things that we think we need to live up to. We certainly don't need to. Masks, hiding, instead of being kind of in a fierce way, vulnerable and open and caring towards ourselves and others, and honest and authentic in the world, having these masks. We know we can't really live within them. There's this tension. And that's kind of, it's often what brings us to the Dhamma too. Taking refuge in the Dhamma is the sense that things just aren't quite right. This sense that things, we know that there's something else. There's a way of relating to experience that isn't that masking way. That's being more real. So taking refuge in loving kindness, extraordinarily important in our particular dominant culture, where the loving kindness towards the self is really not valued at all. In fact, it's almost kind of beaten out of many people from a very young age. Deepa Ma, who is one of my, my hero teacher, actually she taught Howie a lot, so y'all should know that if you are interested in Howie as a teacher, you're getting some trickle-down transmission from Deepa Ma. And she was a teacher of a lot of teachers in this kind of lineage, the Insight tradition. A poor woman living in Calcutta, that's where she was from, and she was an incredible meditation master and said to be extremely cultivated in loving kindness to the point where you could just feel it. You could just feel it when she was there. And she said, the first thing is to love yourself. You cannot progress by self-doubt and self-hatred. You can only progress by self-love. She had these pithy, just really straightforward teachings. that really cut to the heart and cut to the chase of things. And it's really true. In a moment of self-doubt, think of the contraction, the self-doubt and self-hatred, think of the contraction that's in the heart and the way in which we're not turning back to the Dhamma, we're not turning back to mindfulness and loving kindness and relating to our experience with openness. So loving kindness is really kind of what I want to leave you all with in terms of taking refuge in the Dhamma, continuing to turn back to that. Can be really helpful to have a really resonant phrase for yourself, like the encapsulated version of things, as I was talking about in the beginning, of loving kindness when the heart is contracted, and what that self-doubt or self-hatred that Deepa Ma was talking about, to really cut through. One of the ones that for me is, may I be well and safe and protected from inner and outer harm. And often that reminds me that if there's a moment of self-doubt or self-hatred, that it's inner harm, that this is the mind harming the heart, in a sense. And it helps to bring me out of the story. You know, it helps me to bring it, this is what's happening right now. What's happening right now is not the story of self-doubt or self-hatred. It's the inner harm that's happening. So I hope those suggestions, thoughts, offerings on taking refuge in the Dharma were helpful. Just want to thank whoever allowed it tonight. It's a beautiful gift. And there's just a couple minutes left. If there's one or two questions or thoughts, appreciate it. No? Oh, wait, one more minute. Yeah, Susan, hi. Yeah, thank you, Susan. So Susan said the comment was, to paraphrase, thanks, you know, she's happy to hear about talking about loving kindness, because as she gets older, she realizes it's the most important thing, and then sometimes when there's not loving kindness, but then she reminds herself of the loving kindness towards herself, it shifts everything. And it really does, and noticing that shift is a really important part of the practice. Noticing the moment when we abandon what is basically the hatred part, the hatred towards the self, and noticing the feeling and the lightness of heart and the openness that comes when that loving kindness enters the mind stream. The more we notice that, the more that the mind starts to experientially understand how to let go and not fall into that trap as much anymore. So yeah, thank you. Noemi?
Thank you, Susan and Tara. And speaking of Deepa Ma, I read a wonderful quote by her recently where she talks about one cannot practice love and kindness without being mindful.
Mm.
And one cannot be mindful without being in loving kindness, which I really like, because of course if you're really mindful of your true nature, which is loving kindness, of course you're being loving kindness. And then if you're loving kindness, and loving kindness, you'll be mindful. So it's very interconnected. So
yeah.
You sounded like Deepa Ma. Susan.
Thanks, Noemi. I don't think I can improve on that, but it is a really interesting kind of indescribable phenomena to explore the impact of loving kindness on the ability to let go into mindfulness. Because when there's contraction in the heart of any kind, that's really what gets in the way of, someone asked a question about concentration earlier, can really get in the way of just really letting go into opening to what's actually happening right now in the experience. Just fascinating. Loving the relationship between loving kindness as a quality of mind and mindfulness as a quality of mind. So thanks. Okay. Well, thank you all for your attention and for your practice. And let's dedicate the merit. May any benefit that arose from our practice together tonight, from sharing this experience of cultivating mindfulness and loving kindness together, may it touch those around us. May it ripple out, spreading as far and wide as possible to all beings. May the impact touch all beings. May our practice, our efforts, our connection to each other in Sangha, may it serve to awaken all beings. May all beings be well and safe and protected from inner and outer harm.